Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and Robin Williams, thanks so much for everything.
Hello!
Mrs. Doubtfire, just one of the characters created in that furnace of joy and creativity and comedy by Robin Williams. Today we remember a man who forever changed the world of comedy, the big screen, and the hearts of millions of Americans.
My name's Lauren Baldwin. I am from Charleston, South Carolina. My parents got divorced when I was really young, and I remember watching Robin Williams' films, especially Mrs. Doubtfire, and thinking of my dad coming to visit me dressed as a woman and how cool that would be.
This is Eleni Daniels from Queens, New York. The shocking news of Robin Williams' death is really hard to take. It's a deeply painful reminder of how fragile life is and the tremendous joy and laughter that Robin brought to our homes.
This is Diane Buckner from Longview, Washington. Robin, you left too soon. We miss you.
People from all over the nation in an enormous outpouring of emotion, remembering Robin Williams, shocked by the news of his death from a suspected suicide. Robin Williams, who apparently battled inner demons and was never afraid of the big questions of life.
If heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
There's seating near the front. Oh, just a nice, if heaven exists, to know that there's laughter. That would be a great thing.
Oh, yeah.
Just to hear God goes, two Jews walk into a bar.
How were you touched by Robin Williams? We'd love to know. We're sharing stories from you all hour long. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And from the emotional outpouring over the loss of Robin Williams, we want to start this hour by returning to our coverage of the emotional outpouring from a young man's death in a community near St. Louis, Ferguson. People responding to the death of 18-year-old African-American Michael Brown, fatally shot on Saturday during what is reported to be an altercation with local police. The demonstrations and unrest are continuing.
Justice! Now!
Ferguson is one suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, 21,000 people, nearly 70% of whom are black. The town is part of a quilt of diversity and racial and economic disparities that has been the source of tension for decades. In 1917, East St. Louis, Illinois, erupted in some of the most serious racial violence in U.S. history. Clashes between African-American workers and whites fighting over jobs and wage security. It is also the home of Dred Scott, a slave who unsuccessfully sued for his freedom and whose name marks the historic landmark Dred Scott decision. Garrett Albert Duncan knows the long and complicated racial history of St. Louis and the surrounding communities. He's associate professor of African and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor, welcome.
Greetings.
How would you say the stage has been set for tension and racial violence in the St. Louis area based on its growth over the last century?
Well, you know, a lot of what is going on in St. Louis, as well as East St. Louis, is similar to what has happened in other northern cities. For example, the 1917 race riots in East St. Louis is akin to what some folks, or what W.B. Du Bois called a massacre, what some folks call sundown towns or racial exclusion. And it goes way back, actually, to Reconstruction, when the state began operating in support of the white property ownership and whites in general. And so we still see that going on, where the imperatives, especially the white elite, are met and the African-American communities are actually excluded.
And this is reflected, it seems, and you put your finger on this, in the map of St. Louis and its metro area, in the sense that people can see that gateway arch.
Right.
From communities who can never benefit from the sort of symbolic prosperity and, success of St. Louis's story in American history.
You are spot on. That's absolutely correct. And it's actually generational. So this is not something that just happened. Part of what's going on, very specifically as it relates today, is deindustrialization. And if you go to North St. Louis, which is a code word for black, you see all these vacant buildings. There used to be a prosperous, predominantly black community. But when manufacturing, when our economy shift and manufacturers left, you have vacant buildings and a loss of jobs and the inability of black residents to go into the suburbs or predominantly white communities to get jobs. So there's always an economic twist to this.
How would you say the demonstrations in Ferguson and the unrest that we're seeing right now is playing out and resurrecting some of the tensions that you're describing?
Well, first of all, we have to make a distinction between the vigils and the protests. The vigil in Ferguson is basically community-based, and you have people coming from the outside participating in the vigils. Now, some of the destructive behavior is actually outside of Ferguson. You have folks coming in to exploit a situation that has nothing to do with Michael Brown. But everything is being conflated because no one knows who's who. And in many ways, it's inflaming this notion of black criminality. But the fact of the matter is, if you watch carefully, those associated with the death of the young man are pleading for peace in the same way Martin Luther King or Thich Nhat Hanh. But people collapse the two, and we don't see that. And so folks are actually blaming those who are trying to prevent the violence.
I suspect that confusion, the media has really played a role in some of that as we've gone forward over the last few days. Describe to me, is there any history of tension between law enforcement and African-Americans in the St. Louis and the communities around it?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There is a reluctance of the law enforcement agencies, whether in a county or in a city, to really engage the citizens. And part of the political machines are involved in this as well, where there's a refusal to meet people or to establish citizen review boards. That's not going to happen in my lifetime in St. Louis. And so there is this intense distrust, because things tend to always go in a way opposite of the interests of the black communities. And interestingly, the county executive, Charles Dooley, was just defeated soundly. I've never seen an incumbent beat so bad. He lost 66-33% by another Democrat who will always end his ads with, "And I'm a conservative," which is a code word for the support of law enforcement. And for some of us, there's a racially tinged message in that as well.
Finally, Garrett Albert Duncan, Associate Professor of African and African-American Studies at Washington University. Do you think in St. Louis we are revisiting a 1964 moment of tinderbox-like tensions, regardless of what happens on the political level, just as the Voting Rights Act didn't prevent riots throughout America back in the 60s?
Right. No, actually, I will move it up to 1992, or the Rodney King trials and the aftermath of what happened there. And I say this because there might be some superficial changes. And this is what happened back in Los Angeles. I was actually there in Los Angeles. I don't see any major movement going forward out of St. Louis. There are certain cursory, certain, I would say, short-term solutions, but I do not see any long-term solutions.
Garrett Albert Duncan, thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Garrett Albert Duncan is Associate Professor of African and African American Studies at Washington University in St. Louis. Coming up, we'll assess whether some political changes in Iraq are superficial or meaningful in preventing chaos and preventing that nation from slipping into unrest and violence. And, of course, there's no mistaking this voice.
You're a complex Freudian hallucination having something to do with my mother, and I don't know why you have wings.
But you have very lovely legs, and you're a very nice tiny person, and what am I saying? I don't know who my mother was. I'm an orphan, and I'd never taken drugs because I missed the 60s. I was an accountant.
Robin Williams changed everything. There's nobody that wasn't touched by Robin Williams at some point. He was the king. He was the spirit of pure comedy ran through this guy. He was unto himself. There was nobody else like this guy. Nobody else like him ever. And as a comic, despite what any other comics say or whatever your judgment of him as a comedian, he did it all. He did everything that all of us wanted to do, and he did it brilliantly. There's never been a comedic artist like this guy. And there's no more painful realization that the other side of whatever comic genius is sometimes this, that with that sensitivity, that with that perception, that with that empathy, that with that love, that with that mental agility comes a heart too heavy to live, a heart that becomes so heavy that it chooses not to go on for whatever reason. It's horribly sad.
A lot to think about there. Comedian Mark Maron speaking about the loss of Robin Williams, joining Andy Kaufman, Sam Kinison, Lenny Bruce, other comedians who laughed so hard but hurt so deeply inside.
I just wanted to say, my heart is breaking. Robin Williams, you made me laugh, you made me cry, you made me smile. I will miss you.
One of my most favorite shows from Robin Williams was his role in one of the Law and Order episodes. He played this heartbroken man who lost his wife. It was such an emotional performance, and that's something that I will never forget.
About a month ago, my 10-year-old son was playing with a stick, and it recalled my memory of Robin Williams on Sesame Street doing many, many wonderful things with a plain stick. And we shared that together just recently. And that's one of my wonderful memories of Robin Williams.
Someone from our Takeaway family, former producer Brad Milkey, writes, "At my high school senior awards, they unexpectedly read some of our entrance essays from eighth grade, the prompt, 'Who is your hero and why?' As they started to read essays about mothers, fathers, and firefighters, I got very, very nervous because I hadn't written about my dad. I listed my hero as Robin Williams, with his electric performances, his comedic bravery, and his infectious energy. To a nervous eighth grader, these were hero-worthy traits. Absurd, but not really," says Brad. Ricky told us his special remembered moments on Facebook. "One of the best comedy specials I've ever seen is Robin Williams live on Broadway. Both me and my father had tears streaming from laughing so hard. Thank you for the laughs, and be in peace, Mr. Williams."
But there was one guy who treated W with kindness and respect, and that man was Tony Blair. Tony Blair and W was like the United Nations production of Rain Man. It was wonderful. There was sweetness. Tony be going to W. W, do you know the price of gas?
Definitely don't know the price of gas. Don't know the price of gas.
Do you have an economic stimulus package?
Definitely have an economic stimulus package. Might work. Definitely might work. Give each and every American over the age of 20 $1 million. Tax them at a flat tax rate of 10%. Gives back the government $100,000. Gives each and every American $900,000. Might stimulate locally and personally. Definitely might work. Definitely might work.
But W, do you know the price of gas?
Definitely don't know the price of gas.
Where did it all come from? Those voices, those riffs, those improvisations. What's your favorite remembrance of Robin Williams? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE about the man who, for all of us, let the comic genie out of the bottle.
Mr. Aladdin, sir, have a shot, two or three. I'm on the job, you big nay bob. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend, never had a friend. You ain't never had a friend like me.
We want to note a changing of the guard in Iraq now. Iraqis took a step forward by nominating Haider al-Abadi as the country's next prime minister. He's got a reputation as a bridge builder compared with Nouri al-Maliki. Is this a possibly hopeful sign amidst so much chaos in Iraq as the U.S. tries to stave off the encroachment of ISIS militants with the current round of airstrikes?
As I said, when I authorized these operations, there is no American military solution to the larger crisis in Iraq. The only lasting solution is for Iraqis to come together and form an inclusive government.
President Obama speaking to reporters from Martha's Vineyard yesterday, talking about progress in the air campaign so far, stopping the ISIS advance toward the city of Erbil. But thousands of Kurdish Yazidis still remain trapped atop Mount Sinjar. Can an air campaign deal with the humanitarian needs in Iraq and give the country the support to begin the process of saving itself? For more insight on all this, we turn to Mark Gunzinger, retired Air Force colonel and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, who says the best this air campaign can do is buy time for Iraq's leaders.
The limitations in these kinds of operations, which is primarily humanitarian and providing some security for the refugees, in this case the Yazidis, to reach safety, is that there's simply not enough force being applied from the air. just a limited number of targeted airstrikes targeting forces surrounding Yazidis is not going to make much of a difference compared to a serious air campaign, which would be multiple strikes, maybe 200 or 300 strikes a day, that could really attrit the ISIS forces and turn the momentum in the conflict in favor of the Iraqi government.
So you see this as too little, and if time goes on and escalation doesn't happen from the Pentagon, it'll be too late.
That is quite possible. The Pentagon has an opportunity to use its air power in support of ground forces, Iraqi forces, and certainly the Peshmerga, to turn the tide in this conflict without establishing a very large footprint, as they call it, on the ground of U.S. forces.
The president said that he was happy about the change of political leadership in Baghdad. Is there anything going on in Baghdad that can have an impact on the Yazidis on Mount Sinjar?
Well, John, I think you've put your finger on the political winds in Baghdad. A change in prime ministers could, frankly, give hope to groups that are still loyal to the government. In terms of that actually affecting conditions on this in Sinjar Mountains, I'm a little more doubtful. That's a more immediate and tactical situation.
Would you say, and the president stressed this, we played the audio of the president saying there is no military solution in Iraq, something he said before. I'm wondering if, in your view, we're going back to a prolonged American presence in Iraq, not unlike what happened in the 90s, where the U.S. enforced a no-fly zone in northern Iraq and basically was there pretty much 24-7 monitoring the encroachment of forces of Saddam Hussein, as they're doing right now with ISIS?
That's an excellent question, John. There is no U.S. military solution to this problem. This has to be a solution that this has to be a conflict where the Iraqi forces need to prevail. That being said, we can certainly do a lot to support them, much as we did in Afghanistan and even in the Balkans, where host government ground forces, in the case of Afghanistan, the Northern Alliance, were supported by U.S. airstrikes with very, very few Americans on the ground advising them. That could be a model that could apply in this particular situation. I don't think this will be a long-term engagement such as we saw in Operation Northern Watch and Southern Watch in Iraq in the 1990s. That was more about controlling the air and denying it to the Iraqi military, whereas this is really about controlling the ground and denying that to the forces of ISIS. And I don't think that there will be a long-term stalemate.
But tactically speaking, is a large-scale rescue of the Yazidis possible? And what would that get us in terms of a long-term solution here?
I don't think the Yazidis, their rescue, will drive towards a long-term solution. This is a humanitarian crisis that could be resolved by a large rescue operation that would require, frankly, a lot more application of force to suppress the ISIS fighters surrounding the Sinjar Mountains. And, of course, that operation could be supported by vertical lift aircraft, helicopters, and so forth. But right now, it is still a very dangerous situation for very low-flying aircraft, such as helicopters.
But the capability is there in theory.
Well, we certainly have the capability. I don't think the Iraqis have the capability at this moment to do a large-scale evacuation of the Sinjar Mountains with their forces, absent help from the United States and other states as well.
Mark Gunzinger is a retired Air Force colonel and senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Colonel, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Some other thoughts now about people alone, afraid to reach out, for whom maybe just a few simple words might help.
I believe you. It's not your fault.
If some young people could hear those words, they might not feel so alone while dealing with the aftermath of sexual trauma and the consequences of abuse. Seattle area writer Lindy West has made those words the rallying cry for a very special new blog and social network called simply, I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault. West wanted to create a space online that came close to the sanctuary she found with a group of women who have come together to share honest fears and to seek support about subjects that are hard for anyone to talk about.
A woman shared a story about her 12-year-old daughter who has a friend who's been really severely sexually harassed at school and comes from a family that's really buys into the narrative that, you know, sexual harassment and abuse like that are the girl's fault for maybe dressing the wrong way or leading boys on. And this girl had really internalized those ideas. And according to this woman, was convinced that it was her fault and she was just an attention whore and that the next time this happened, she should just comply and go along with what these boys wanted. And she doesn't have anyone at home to counter that narrative and to say, no, you are allowed to draw your own boundaries and defend those boundaries. That's a good thing. And your body belongs to you. And this isn't your fault.
The blog, I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault, has found a rapidly growing community of young people looking for a place to share safely and to take support without fear of judgment. Lindy West says the project has struck a chord.
People write me letters that are mostly first-person accounts of things that happened to them and how they got through them and where they are now. And most of the stories are about sexual assault or rape, but there's also stories, we have stories about disability and eating disorders and, you know, sort of toxic parents, emotionally abusive parents, dealing with bullying at school. And I'm hoping to keep expanding the scope of what we talk about. And then we have another component to the site, which is that we have an anonymous ask box. So anyone can write in anonymously and ask anything they need to ask. And then I have a panel of people who have contributed letters, and I send the questions to them, and we all sort of answer them as a group.
And the simplest idea of all is the title, which is a reassuring voice from really the darkness for an adolescent dealing with these issues.
Yeah, definitely. So the title is just, I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault, which are two things that came up over and over and over when we were initially discussing this idea that everyone said they always needed to hear and didn't hear. Because we spend so much time trying to categorize different kinds of assault and which kinds of rape count and which ones don't. I mean, you hear politicians doing this, you know, as though there are different grades of trauma or of assault and some count more than others. We spend so much time trying to discredit victims and trying to, you know, question people's accounts of their own trauma. So to just have a space where people can tell stories and not be questioned and not be judged is really, really valuable. And, you know, that's all we are. It's just a big rock of solidarity. You can tell us what happened. We believe you. It's not your fault.
So you started a Tumblr, and the idea of fault really became central to the identity of this.
Yeah, definitely. It's amazing how entrenched the idea is that victims are somehow complicit in things that happen to them. That this original girl, this story that where it all started, she was convinced that she shouldn't have made a scene. She shouldn't have told because it made a scene and then the boys got in trouble and she made a scene. She didn't make a scene. The boys made a scene. You know, people are so worried about speaking out about their abuse, especially if it's from a family member or someone that you love or someone who's supposed to take care of you. The way that's framed is that, oh, you're causing this rift in the family. No, your abuser caused this rift in the family. People carry around a ton of blame and guilt and shame for things that were done to them. And it's really victimizing that person twice.
Have you encountered anyone on this blog who you believed was in real danger?
We've gotten some really disturbing questions in the ask box, and a couple people who I've just written back to privately, sending them some resources to different services that I think might be able to help them. I've consulted a couple of mental health professionals that I know just privately to help some of these kids out. But some of the stuff that we're getting is really astonishing. You know, I was raped by my sister's boyfriend 3 weeks ago. And what now? I feel like hurting myself. What do I do? Which to a certain extent feels way over my head. I mean, I'm not a mental health professional, but we do have this big pool of contributors who've been through all of these things. And I think just a lot of people who've written in, even saying really intense, urgent things like that, have also said it really helps to just be able to tell someone. So hopefully the combination of being heard and being supported, and then also being directed to organizations and support systems that could, you know, give some real tangible on the ground help to these kids, will be productive in the long run.
Have you seen that tangibly on the site? I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault, of people beginning with real fear and not knowing where to go and getting counseling and the response and the impact that it had on them?
I mean, there have been a couple people who wrote in and said, I've never told anyone this before and I don't know what to do, who then wrote back just grateful to have been listened to. So I'm hoping that people will take steps in real life outside of just talking to us. But it seems like just naming the problem and talking about it to someone and having the courage to even speak what happened to you is a first step.
Hmm. Any insights for your own family?
My kids are 10 and 12, and I told them about the blog, and they were like, oh, cool. You know, like they got to be cool about it. But I, you know, I hope that they will remember that it's there and read it. It's difficult stuff. I don't want to force them to read it because it is kind of scary to read. But I know that they know it's there. And I hope that, you know, when their friends or God forbid they go through any of these things, that they look to it as a resource.
Lindy West is a staff writer at Jezebel, founder and editor of I Believe You, It's Not Your Fault. Lindy, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you so much.
We don't read and write poetry because it's cute.
I came home last evening and my teenage kids were watching the movie Dead Poets Society. Dad, did you hear about Robin Williams? One of them asked, heartbroken, touched by the news of his passing like so many. Why, Dad? She asked. He was so amazing.
We read and write poetry because we are members of the human race. And the human race is filled with passion. And medicine, law, business, engineering, these are noble pursuits and necessary to sustain life. But poetry, beauty, romance, love, these are what we stay alive for.
A scene from Dead Poets Society. The clown, himself a manic poet of comic energy, dead from an apparent suicide at his home in Marin County. After decades of struggling with demons, depression, the weight of something he carried, even as he made all of us laugh.
I would like to do Shakespeare's only unknown work, so that's the way you lick it.
Wow! Does it feel good to be out of there? I'm telling you, nice to be back, ladies and gentlemen. Hi, where are you from? What's your name?
Aladdin.
Aladdin! Hello, Aladdin. Nice to have you on the show. Can we call you Al, or maybe just Din? Or how about Laddie? Sounds like, here, boy. Come on, Laddie.
Could you tell me your name?
My name? I thought I gave it to you, dear.
No.
Oh. Doubtfire.
I beg your pardon?
Doubtfire, dear? Mrs. Doubtfire.
What is a demilitarized zone? Sounds like something out of the Wizard of Oz.
Oh, no, don't go in there.
Oh, hee-ho, Ho Chi Minh.
Oh, look, you've landed in Saigon. You're among the little people now.
We represent the Arvern Army, the Arvern Army. Oh, no, follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Follow the Ho Chi Minh Trail.
Mindy, why are you mad at your coat?
Because my watch stopped.
Ah, and you suspect your coat.
No, my watch stopped and I got a ticket.
Oh, no, when I watch stuff, we only get a warning and they take away Mickey's hands.
That's from the 70s TV show Mork and Mindy, where Williams entertained tens of millions of people with invented words and outrageous antics. From that show to his renegade voice of joy and irreverence in Good Morning Vietnam. From the voice of the genie in Aladdin, the unforgettable Mrs. Doubtfire. He made the world laugh. He was also a deeply serious artist in films and performances just as moving as any of his comedy.
Why did you sneak around at night and finish other people's formulas that only one or two people in the world could do and then lie about? Because I don't see a lot of honor in that, Will.
We'll take the house.
Garp!
Honey, the chances of another plane hitting this house are astronomical. See, it's been pre-disastered.
Opening your door to those in need, those in pain, caring for them, listening to them, applying a cold cloth until a fever breaks. If this is practicing medicine, if this is treating a patient, then I am guilty as charged, sir.
What we do know is as the chemical window closed, another awakening took place.
Serious Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting, for which he won an Oscar. In The World According to Garp, playing the sentimental real-life Patch Adams. And lastly there, his role as a doctor based on the real-life story of Dr. Oliver Sacks in the film Awakenings.
That the human spirit is more powerful than any drug. And that is what needs to be nourished.
Robin Williams, always raw and vulnerable, and also, we learn, hiding behind that curtain of candor. Who was Robin Williams really? His friends may know. He tried to tell us in his candid conversations about the demons he fought all his life.
And look what we do for a living in terms of stand-up. You get to do stuff that if you did it, you know, just on the street, people go, that man, he talked about his penis to me openly. And you're going, but you're doing it in a club. All of a sudden there's license to thrill, that old thing. You can do this stuff. But, like you said, the line, stepping over and back over the line of like, what are you going to find out? You're going to find out that, you know, you're this weird, insecure guy who does this and looks and looking like Lenny Bruce said, for love. Going, do you love me?
Yeah.
Temporarily?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah.
And then and can you put that at risk going, I don't care if you love me. I got to say this. And that's where I guess sometimes you can go, is that an artist or is that a sociopath?
An interview there on Mark Maron's podcast, WTF. Williams spoke often of his addictions. His addiction to Peruvian marching powder, cocaine, as he called it. Something he says he was drawn to. Anything that makes you paranoid and impotent, give me more of that, he once told an audience. He took wild risks as a performer. His impressions of Jacques Cousteau. There was this 15-second monologue condensing the entire story of the epic Roots. Riffs that he seemed to channel from somewhere.
I saw World Cup, baby. No! Few soccer fans, the rest of you are going,
oh, that's like football without pads, right?
For the rest of the world, it's football. For us, it's like
a strange sport played by damaged people.
But we made it in the World Cup. Everybody plays it. Not like the World Series, because the French don't have a baseball team. If they did, they would only have left field, and no one would be safe. You know what I'm saying? What can you do, huh?
His was a comedy that hurt no one but himself. An energy that always seemed too much to contain, orbiting the sun, but always with humanity. Crusading, it seemed, for all of us.
Do you know who I am?
Some kind of vigilante?
Well, that happens along the way, of course. But here's a clue. I'm a knight on a special quest. And I need help.
That's a scene from the movie The Fisher King. And in talking to people in the movie trade last night, shooters, set designers, some assistant directors, all with a Williams story, all shocked by his death. I heard this story about the movie The Fisher King. It starred Williams and Jeff Bridges. Williams plays that knight you just heard, a homeless man, a messiah character, looking for his one true love, played by Amanda Plummer in a crowd.
Never gonna find her in this crowd.
She's like clockwork, Jack. She comes through here at the same time every day. She's late.
The story goes that in Fisher King, director Terry Gilliam was shooting this massively complex scene in Grand Central Station, filled with extras, and for hours, take after retake, huge, ambitious crowd scenes that he wanted just right. The extras were fading, getting weary, getting annoyed. Everyone could see that their energy was sapped, the scene was failing, the director was losing his massive crowd. Until, suddenly Williams broke into his comedian mode and went around to each group of extras, boosting them, making them laugh, restoring their energy, saving the scene, saving the movie with his own force of nature.
Welcome to Iron Chef. First of all, tonight we are going to cook octopus balls. As you know, they're 8 legs, so you get 4 sets of balls.
I have no idea if that story is true, but I don't care. I think Robin Williams was always doing that with all of us, rooting us on, boosting our energy, always inventing some way to make us laugh.
What do you mean you do voices?
We've come to this planet looking for intelligent life. Oops, we made a mistake.
We're happy to be in America. Don't ask for a green card.
I want you in the worst way.
Well, this is certainly a rough meeting, and it's not going very well for me, I'll tell you that.
Look at me right now, Moneypenny. I want to undo that bow and get to know you.
The comedy just never worked on him, I guess. I lost my husband and best friend, William's wife Susan Schneider said yesterday, while the world lost one of its most beloved artists and beautiful human beings.
Robin Williams was like the sun. He had so much energy. He shone on so many people with his comedy, with his drama. He was just an amazing human being, and you can see that in everything that he did.
I can't tell you how much this man meant to me. He helped me battle my own issues with mental health problems, addiction in my family, and he made life a whole lot more bearable. Losing him is like losing one of my best friends. Robin, I love you. I hope that you, wherever you are, you're happy now and that your laughter can come from a place without so much pain. Thank you for your gifts to all of us. Rest in peace.
Goodbye, Robin Williams. May you find peace, finally.
And I am what I am, what I am, and I am what I am, and that's all that I am, because I am what I am. You got it?
I think so.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.